why don't you join me then for our last study in Daniel chapter 6. I want to title this study, Darius the Evangelist. We are in the very end of a whole section of the book of Daniel. The whole section comprises the first six chapters, actually. The first six chapters are focused more on the story of Daniel, the story of his life, the narrative of what the Lord did with him, what the Lord did through him. There is, of course, as we've seen, like in chapter 2, for instance, some very deep and rich teaching sections of the book of Daniel in terms of doctrinal instruction, prophetic instruction in the form of sections of meaty passages. But for the most part, we've been dealing with stories, one event unfolding after the other, like we've just been in this chapter focused on the famous story of Daniel in the lion's den and how the Lord miraculously rescued him from that lion's den. We're at the end of that story section, and then next study, of course, we're shifting gears as we move forward from chapter 7 through to the end of the book, and the material is going to change. But I want us to notice tonight, as we read this very last portion of the story part of Daniel's life, how this story ends. Now, I'm not saying that Daniel's story doesn't continue in chapter 7 through 12. We're going to see glimpses of Daniel in certain circumstances, but most of the material from here on out is prophecy. Most of it's going to be more in-depth material. So pay attention tonight as the Lord draws this portion of the book to a close. The story unfolds and finishes in a particularly important way. So let's read. And of course here, this is immediately after Daniel has been rescued from the lion's den. And we'll read from verse 25 through the end of chapter 6. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. All right, now we've identified already in our study of this chapter and the interaction between Daniel and King Darius, that King Darius is a different kind of pagan king. He certainly starts the story with no true knowledge of the Lord and no personal relationship with the Lord. But his heart, and this is all by the grace of God, it's not just because Darius is such a good man and a good person, but by the grace of God, his heart has been, from the beginning of the story, his part of the story, more favorably inclined toward Daniel personally and ultimately toward Daniel's God. And now he's personally witnessed God at work. And there's no real denying it. There's no refuting it. You know how it is in our generation. You know, God can do some amazing and wonderful thing, and men will look at it and ignore it or pretend that it didn't happen or explain it away or justify it or rationalize it. And men were the same in Darius's generation. Human nature hasn't changed from the time of Darius to today's time. We're just more sophisticated in the way that we live out and express our human nature. But the Lord had done something in the eyes of Darius that he couldn't argue with. He couldn't rationalize and justify and explain away unless his heart was 100% committed to denying the truth. And the only option he had at that point would be to turn his back entirely on the truth and move wholeheartedly into greater and greater darkness. But by the grace of God, Darius is not inclined to do that. Instead, he witnesses his most favored servant in his kingdom, his right-hand man, Daniel, undergo a decree of execution by being thrown into this lion's den. And we saw at the end of that story how dangerous that was when later the conspirators that attempted to take out Daniel were themselves thrown into the lion's den along with their families and how they were immediately killed. The king fully expected that would happen to Daniel. When Daniel was thrown into the lion's den and the lion's den is sealed and he spends this fitful night without rest, he comes the next morning fully expecting Daniel to be dead, but with a half of a hope that perhaps the God of Daniel might have done something special. And of course, what he finds is Daniel is not just alive, not just surviving, not just, you know, barely hanging on to life. He finds Daniel unharmed, untouched, unscathed completely from the lions in his presence. And when he calls out to Daniel, Daniel explains to him that God had sent his angel and had closed the mouths of the lions. So at that point, Darius is confronted with a miraculous, awesome, unusual, special display of God's involvement in his world and specifically in the life of Daniel. And there's only two things a heart can do with that. You either refuse to believe it in spite of the obvious evidence in front of you, or you embrace the truth of what that act, that miraculous act, implies. And really it is an implication, because for the king, he sees Daniel alive, but what doesn't he see? He doesn't see the angel that rescued Daniel. He doesn't see God on his throne in the heavens who sent his angel. All he sees is the result of the miracle, the fruit of the miracle, and hears the testimony to the miracle by the man who experienced it himself. And so when his heart is confronted with that, he has a choice to make, and the choice he makes is a good choice. It's the right choice. It's the choice every human being should make when confronted with the miraculous evidence of the truth, but many don't. And his choice is to embrace the implications of that truth. Now, it's interesting to me that from the end of verse 24, which is how the families of the conspirators and the conspirators themselves, the ringleaders of this conspiracy to end Daniel's life, were thrown into the lion's den and are consumed by the lions. And verse 25, where it says, "Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, languages, nations of the earth." We don't see any backstory in between those two verses. There's no explanation of what happened between the end of verse 24 and the beginning of verse 25. But verse 25 is a royal proclamation, a decree that goes out from the center of the Medo-Persian Empire, which at that time was the greatest, the most powerful world-dominating empire. It would be like, the equivalent would be, if the President of the United States issued a formal presidential proclamation from Washington, D.C., and directed it not just to the citizens of the United States, but to the citizens of the world. That's the extent of the communication from Darius. And what's amazing, of course, is the substance of the message. What he has to say in this message. What he focuses on. What he is concerned to proclaim to the nations. And what's meant to grab our heart's attention is, where did that come from in the heart of this king? Because he did not know the Lord. He was, up until this time, exclusively a worshiper of false gods and idols. He was a man like all other men of the Medes and the Persians, committed to worshiping the gods of the Medes and the Persians. And here he makes proclamation as though he, not Daniel, is a true prophet of God. As though he, not Daniel, is speaking on behalf of the Lord. I would have zero problem with this chapter ending with a proclamation that the king allowed Daniel to make to the nations. You know, this is a proclamation from Daniel, the governor of, you know, the empire of the Medes and the Persians under the authority of the great King Darius. I, Daniel, proclaim this. But it's not coming from Daniel. Now, there's good reason to believe that most likely Daniel had some influence in what Darius issued as a decree to the nations. How can we draw that conclusion? Again, there's no backstory between verse 24 and verse 25. But the wording is very Daniel-like. It's very similar. In fact, we'll read in a few minutes. It's almost identical, at least in the introduction, to a previous decree that another king that had been influenced by the ministry and life of Daniel had proclaimed to the nations. That was, in an earlier generation, King Nebuchadnezzar. And we saw that that was likely written with Daniel's help and with Daniel's influence. So it's entirely possible that between 24 and 25, Daniel and Darius sat down, discussed further the implications of what happened in the lion's den, and that the king made this decision to write this decree and to publish it to all the nations. And he may have even had Daniel act as one who took dictation, writing down for him and phrasing it in a particular way. But we don't know for sure that that's the case. All we know is this declaration represents the king, which means it's an expression from his own heart. It's the fruit of the Lord's influence in Darius's heart. Now, I'm calling this message Darius the Evangelist with an intent to catch your heart's attention. What is an evangelist from our you know, new covenant now biblical perspective and understanding? What is an evangelist? Okay, it's someone who proclaims the gospel, someone who's called by the Lord, given a special gift and a special assignment and mission to proclaim the gospel. The evangelist ministry is distinguished, for instance, from the pastor's ministry in a very important way. Pastors certainly are meant to be proclaimers of the gospel, but pastors do more than simply proclaim the gospel. Whereas evangelists, their whole job description is, the term evangelist means one who proclaims the good news, or one who as a messenger carries and bears the good news. And I'm calling Darius an evangelist because there's an amazing thing that takes place at the end of this story portion of the book of Daniel. And that is this. I want you to think, before we dig into the details of the message, I want you to think with me on a big picture level of what's just taken place. The Lord, let's go all the way back to, for a moment, we'll come back to Daniel 12. Or Daniel says, go with me if you would for a moment though to all the way back to Genesis chapter 12. The Lord has a purpose in history. And the whole Bible is the story of the unfolding of that purpose, the fulfillment progressively throughout generations of history and throughout different events of history of that purpose. And that purpose certainly started before chapter 12 of Genesis. But we see something in Genesis 12 that specifically identifies that purpose for us in a particular way. I want to read from what is commonly referred to as the call of Abram, who later is identified by the Lord, renamed by the Lord as Abraham. And I want to read from verse 1 of Genesis 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. and I will make of you a great nation. Now, we haven't directly studied Abram's life in any recent studies that we've done. Is anyone familiar with the cultural and social background of Abram, his land, and his family? Because the Lord says to him, go from your country, go from your kindred, go from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, meaning I'm about to start over in history with you as the focal point of my purpose. But what was the story of the background of Abram's land, culture, and family history? They were idol worshipers. The particular brand, you know how many brands there are of idol worship in the world and throughout history? There's millions. But the particular brand that they practiced was moon worship. So the Lord calls one man out of the midst of a culture, a land, and a family of idolaters. And he says, you're going to be distinct. And I have a special purpose for you. And he first calls him into covenant relationship with himself. He changes the man. And in changing the man, he announces that he's going to fulfill through that man a special purpose in history. Let's read on. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will, what? Why will I bless you? Why will I make your name great? So that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And here's my great purpose for having called you out of your land, your culture, your family. Here's my great purpose for you. I will do what? I will cause all the families of the earth to be blessed in you. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, this is a category. All families, and here it's not just like individual families, like the Forests, the Spajaris. It's not like individual families only. We're talking about families of peoples, groupings of peoples. All families of the earth will be blessed in you. Meaning that the blessing that God is about to unfold for their lives will be like this. Here's, I'm diagramming the earth. Here's Abram, a lone man on the surface of the earth. Here's heaven above him. And God is going to funnel his blessing from heaven into Abraham. He's going to fill him to the full. And then through him, he's going to cause that blessing to overflow and spill out until it covers and ultimately blesses the population of the entire planet. Now, we're not talking here about every single individual, but we're talking about a clearly universal purpose. We simply mean by that, this is a purpose not just for the people of Abraham only, not just for the people that will come from his line of descent only, not just for the people of this particular region of the world only. This is a purpose that is going to affect and impact all the families on the face of the earth. Do we see and can we agree that this is a brief but significantly important description of God's great purpose for Abraham? Now, Abraham, of course, becomes the father of the Old Covenant people of God. He fathers Isaac, who fathers Jacob, who fathers 12 sons, who become the 12 tribes of Israel. And that promise is not ultimately fulfilled only through Abraham as an individual alone. It's ultimately fulfilled through those in his family line who carry on the greatness of this covenant purpose from generation to generation. So, what we're meant to understand from that is that God's purpose to bless all the families of the earth through the line of Abraham continues forward through each progressive generation of history that follows Abraham, meaning that all those who are from his line of descent are born into a special purpose and calling. What is that special purpose and calling? For all the families of the earth to be blessed through them. For them to first be filled with God's blessing, and then that blessing of God overflow their lives so that it blesses the life of everyone around them. And not just immediately and directly around them, but everyone on the face of the earth. No people groups exempt. No tribes left out. No languages untouched and unaffected by this great universal purpose of God. Now, as we're skipping now, historically, if we're on a timeline here, from Abraham to the time of Daniel. A lot of generations between these two men, right? Did God's purpose end anywhere between Abraham and Daniel? Like, okay, we've gone this far with it. That wasn't such a great idea. This is the Lord speaking. And we're going to end it here with Moses. Or we're going to end it here with, you know, whoever else, David. The purpose never ends between Abraham and Daniel. If anything, it only expands in its expression and implications. Each successive great leader expands the obvious universal implications of God's original purpose announced and given to Abraham. But here's the big problem historically between Abraham and Daniel. While God's purpose hasn't changed, while God's purpose hasn't diminished, the cooperation of the ones in the earth who were chosen to accomplish that purpose, through whom God is going to bring about the fulfillment of that purpose, the cooperation level wanes dramatically at different times in history, to where it gets so bad at some points. It's not just that they're working in cooperation with the Lord to represent the Lord properly to all the families of the earth. They're working at times against God's purpose and actively seeking to leave the nations out of this understanding. This is just for us and for no one else except us. And of course, there's the other issue of them, instead of going out and influencing and affecting the nations, they go out and, too much so, are influenced by the nations. So that instead of transforming how the nations think about God, the nations transform in the wrong way how they relate to God. And they begin to adopt the practices, religious and spiritually, of the nations around them and blend the true worship of the one true God with the worship of various idols and false gods around them. This is what is taking place immediately before the story of Daniel starts. This great purpose of God is at its lowest ebb ever since Abraham. That's why Israel is in captivity in Babylon. It's because they have rejected their relationship, their unique and special relationship with God. They've substituted false gods and idols for that relationship. And as a result, anything they have to share to the nations is not this great truth of who the Lord is. It's that, you know, what you nations believe is what we believe. And so it's a tremendously low moment in God's unfolding purpose in history, with an exception or two. In this case, in the book of Daniel, we see there are a grand total of how many exceptions so far in the book of Daniel? Four. Four individuals that have not blended completely with the nations around them, embracing their false gods. That's Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. Those four and those four alone have remained true to the Lord. And at this point in the story, of course, three of those men apparently have come to the end of their life, because Daniel himself is a very old man at this point. He's the only one mentioned out of those four. And there's no hint that the other three ever veered off in any unhealthy way. So now, at this point in the story, we are down to one single faithful man who has remained true to the Lord, true in his relationship to the Lord, true in his representation of the Lord, and everyone else of Abraham's line is compromised and blended in with the nations around them. And we look at this and we say, this is what we're meant to think at first glance. That great purpose of God announced all the way back in Genesis chapter 12 and rehearsed and repeated in various formats throughout Israelite history, it's apparently never going to be fulfilled. What a sad, sad thing it is, because we're down to one man and there's no possible way God can accomplish this purpose with one faithful person left on the face of the earth. All hope is lost. It's the end of the story. So what does God do? Well, he works a miracle. The first miracle, of course, is just maintaining Daniel's heart in such a gloriously faithful place through all of the pressures of his 60-year-long faithful service to the Lord in the midst of a whole culture that was like a daily lion's den for him. But here we are now at this end point of the story. Daniel has survived the lion's den miraculously by the grace of God, comes out alive on the other side. And what does the Lord do? The Lord speaks through the miracle and through this one man's faith and this one man's faithfulness and his faithful testimony of the Lord. And who does he speak to? No one else is talking. It's just Daniel. So what does the Lord do? Through that, he chooses out of everybody still alive on the face of the earth the single most influential man in all of the world. Who is that man? Darius. And what does he say to this man, Darius's heart? He says to him, look at the truth, you can't deny it. And Darius is impacted by it, and he is so impacted that he does what Israel has failed to do for generations of time, and he makes a proclamation to the nations that, in part, it's not the final story, the ultimate story is fulfilled in Christ himself, but in part fulfills the promise of Genesis chapter 12. In this proclamation that Darius makes, it is a fulfillment promise or fulfillment process of Genesis 12, I think it's verse 3. Genesis 12, 3. How do I draw that connection? Well, let me read again verse 3. The Lord speaking to Abram generations of time before this, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. This happens, by the way, in Daniel's life in a very dramatic way in the lion's den circumstance. Darius blesses him even as he's going into the lion's den, and God is going to turn around and bless Darius. What's the greatest blessing? I mean, he's got everything else. He's got everything a man could want in the world. What does he give him that's greater than that? Understanding of the truth. Insight and understanding, revelation of the truth. This is the true and living God. And what does he do with those who were cursing Daniel, trying to undercut his life and his position and remove him from the picture? He causes those individuals to be thrown into the lion's den. They fall in their own trap. So the Lord had promised, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you, that's in your line, Abram, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now let's go back to Daniel 6 and reread the decree of Darius with that backdrop and perspective in our minds. Then King Darius wrote to who? All the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. All the families of the earth. And what does he write them? He writes them something that if they'll pay attention to it, if they'll listen to it, they will be blessed exactly the way the Lord described in Genesis chapter 12. Because this is the truth. This is the most important thing these peoples, languages, and nations have ever heard declared to them ever in their lives. It's the most important royal proclamation that had ever been made in history up until this moment in time. For overshadowing all prior proclamations. And the Lord, through Darius, interestingly, through Darius, blesses all the families of the earth. Now, the promise was to the line of descent of Abraham, and of course Darius is not in that line of descent, but the point being, the only reason Darius has this understanding is because of the faithfulness of this one last faithful descendant of Abraham, who is Daniel. So he wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, that of course refers now to the boundaries of his influence and authority, which is the Medo-Persian Empire, greatest empire on the face of the earth at that time in history. He can't force anyone outside of that dominion to pay attention, but nevertheless, he's speaking to them to say, you should be paying attention to this, whether you're under my dominion or not. It certainly applies to everyone. And he says, people, this is the decree. This is what Darius wants who to do. All the peoples of the world, all of the languages of the world, all of the nations of the entire world. He's saying, this is what you should do. You should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God. This is emphasized in the way it's written so that the he is the focal point. It's not he is, you know, the living God among many other living gods. He is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed. His dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. This is an awesome evangelistic proclamation. Can you imagine if the President of the United States made this proclamation, not just on some special religious holiday just for the citizens of this nation? That would be impressive and would be unusual for a president of the United States in this modern generation to do such a thing. But I'm saying way beyond that, if the president of the United States issued this exact decree and said, this is what every nation, language, people group, and culture out there in the world should do. They should bow and tremble and fear before the one true God in exclusion to all other gods. What would happen? I mean, think about the implications of what was going on here. As hard as that is for us to imagine the President of the United States doing that today, we live in a so-called Christian culture that at least has 200 years of Christian history and influence behind it, so that it wouldn't be the most shocking thing ever in history. Darius was not a product of a Christian culture. The peoples could not imagine Darius, the king of the Medes and the Persians, saying such a thing on behalf of the God of the Hebrews and the Jews. It was shocking. And it's because it was so shocking that the Lord picked Darius to be the proclaimer. See, the Lord could have had Daniel issue this proclamation, but it wouldn't have come across with the same impact. It would impact people uniquely because it's coming from someone who had such a contrary religious and spiritual perspective, coming from a culture that gave no room for that whatsoever. I mean, remember this. We've talked about this back when we were studying through Nebuchadnezzar's part of the story. The Jews were a conquered people, and in those days, the way that worked is if one nation conquered another, it was a signal that the God of the conquering nation was superior to the God of the conquered nation. So it was the expected message would be, Darius is letting everybody in the world know that the gods of the Medes and the Persians are greater than the God of the Jews. But he does exactly the opposite of that. It's something that could only happen if God has dramatically changed the heart of the man making the proclamation. So we have to answer the question, and I can't give you a definitive answer. I just give you my opinion. Was Darius saved? You can read through a variety of really good commentaries on the book of Daniel, and you get an interesting cross-section of opinions on this particular point, many of which believe that Darius was not saved because of one particular phrasing that he used in this proclamation. And at the end of verse, or right toward the end of verse 26, where he says, people are to tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. This is Darius speaking. And, you know, they make a good point, some of these commentators, to say, if this was his own faith now, he would say, before the God of Darius. But I believe that that's not a valid objection to raise in this particular case, because if he had proclaimed the God of Darius, what would peoples of the world thought? They would have thought of the idols that the Persians and the Medes always worshipped, and that he was making a proclamation representing his God. But by identifying him as distinct and unique from himself, as the God of Daniel, the God who's rescued miraculously Daniel, the God who he now identifies as the one true and living God, is to me a very subtle but very effective way of distinguishing the God of Daniel from the false gods that he has previously worshipped. Personally, I believe Darius was saved. I believe he was transformed. But even if he wasn't, it doesn't diminish the awesome display of God's sovereignty in the heart and life and perspective of this king. In a sense, if he's not saved, it makes it, in one sense, even greater. That here's a man who doesn't really have a personal relationship with the Lord, and yet God has so transformed his, at least, perspective about the God that Daniel worships, that he's willing to make a royal proclamation to a God that he has no personal investment in whatsoever, no personal interest in whatsoever, and he's willing to be his representative in this proclamation to all the world. But I do believe that Darius, it's like this principle, it's a biblical principle, and that is that a tree is known in what way? By the fruit that it bears. So when you encounter an apple tree, you can be certain that it's an apple tree if you see apples growing on the tree. And if pears are growing on the tree instead of apples, you can be certain, I thought it was an apple tree, but it really wasn't an apple tree. It was actually a pear tree, because apple trees don't give pears, and pear trees don't give apples. So I don't know about you, but I read this declaration, and I wonder, out of what kind of heart could this declaration possibly come? And it seems to me that this is the heart of a man who has been laid hold of by God, the true and living God. And he may not have, no doubt, he doesn't yet have full understanding of all the implications. And we don't know what happens in the life of Darius after this event, because his part of the story ends right here. And it doesn't even matter what happens to him after this. What does matter is that he was so impacted that God brought this out of him. And God, through him, fulfilled in part, leading up to the greater part that can only be fulfilled in Christ, but fulfilled through him a promise that he had made all the way back to Genesis chapter 12 to Abraham, and had in large part remained unfulfilled through all these generations of Israel's unfaithfulness. And yet, it's like the extent that the Lord has to go. If I have to go and grab an unbeliever who is an idol worshiper and do a miracle in front of that person that they can't argue with or deny, and then transform their perspective and cause them to make a proclamation that my own people are not making, then I'll do that in order to get the message out and to fulfill the promise that I made to Abraham and to fulfill my great purpose in history. And so I believe the Lord is actually accomplishing that. The other thing I want us to notice is, and this goes along with my what if the president of the United States scenario did something like this, I want us to just notice how bold Darius is. How unapologetic in his proclamation he is. He doesn't soften the proclamation by saying, look, I know some of you out there are Muslims, and I know some of you out there are Buddhists, and I know some of you out there are Hindus, and I know some of you out there are tree worshipers, and I know some of you out there are New Agers, and I know some of you out there worship yourself. I know some of you out there are this, and I know some of you are out there are doing that. And, you know, whatever works for you is great, and as long as it makes you feel good about your life, that's all that matters. But here, let me just share with you a new thought to add to your perspective. He doesn't approach it like that. He boldly, courageously, unapologetically says, this is the truth. And this is the true God. This is the living God. This is the way it is. And if you think otherwise, the implication in the declaration is this: if you think otherwise, you're wrong. And that's all there is to it. And the sad thing is, this pagan, idolatrous king is so much more bold than most believers are, who have been given so much more than he was ever given. Now, Darius was given a lot. I mean, to witness a miracle like the lion's den firsthand, that's a lot. To witness the years of Daniel's faithful service unto his God is a lot. God opened his eyes to see a lot. But whatever God opened Darius' eyes to see is nothing compared to what God has opened our eyes to see. And yet, we tend to be so hesitant to just boldly and clearly proclaim the truth to those who don't know it and believe it and are living in darkness and lost in that darkness. Darius is not concerned about that. He has been given a message by the God who sits enthroned in the heavens. And his job is simply to deliver that message to everyone that he's supposed to deliver it to. Because he has a lot of resources at his disposal, he has what I would call a fairly easy avenue, which is, I'm just going to make a royal proclamation and I'm going to disseminate that throughout my entire empire and it will get to all of the nations. Since it was addressed to all the peoples, languages, and nations, we don't know the backstory again, but the implication is he probably sent royal official messengers, emissaries, to every royal court throughout the world with this decree, just like ambassadors are sent in our present generation with messages from one world leader to another. This was a message to all world leaders. And it was, again, without apology, without hesitation, without explanation like, you know, I need to soften this up and I need to, you know, present this in this nice, smooth way. There's nothing smooth about his proclamation at all. It is an offensive proclamation. Why? Because it's an exclusive proclamation of the truth. Anytime anyone in this world today, this world in which, you know, everything goes and anything goes and whatever you believe is okay with everyone, supposedly, except the truth. But in this cultural backdrop, for anyone to stand up in any kind of public venue, whether it's at your place of business, whether it's in a social setting, whether it's in a, you know, an activity group, whether it's in the newspaper, writing to the editor, whether it's on the internet, in any forum, any venue that you have, for anyone to stand up and say, what I'm about to say is the truth, and if you don't believe this, you are flat out wrong. Here is the truth of who the one true God is. And this is the nature of this one true God, and this is his message. What happens in our world today when someone dares to speak in that manner? Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, who are you, you know, to be telling me that you have an exclusive avenue on the truth? And this was true in a different way in Darius's day, just like it's true today, because like I said, human nature hasn't changed. We've just become more pronounced and subtle in our ways of expressing the same issues of human nature. But I want us to catch from his example. This is a model for true believers to recognize that God gives us moments and he gives us opportunities to represent him in a dark and lost world around us. And when the time comes, you don't have to be mean, you don't have to be ornery, you don't have to be nasty, but you do have to be bold, and you do need to be clear, and you do need to be substantive, and you do need to be courageous. And that's exactly what Darius was. Now, the end of the story is in verse 28. So, this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And this is the end of Daniel's personal story. Again, there are going to be brief moments where other parts of his story are told to us in the later chapters, but they're all flashbacks. This is really the end of Daniel's personal life story. And it ends with this special biblical word, prosperity. But let's not mistake and misunderstand. We're not talking about, you know, Daniel ended up a rich man. He was a billionaire before he died. We're not talking about money at all. I mean, I don't doubt that he had enough personal resources. He was high up in the Persian government, and I'm sure he had it. You know, he was well compensated for his service, and he had everything he needed and wanted, I'm sure. But that's not the focus here of prosperity. That's not what we're talking about. His life was rich. His life was filled with the blessing of God, and the focus here isn't on material blessings, it's on the nature of his relationship with the Lord and the great fruitfulness the Lord gave him in influencing and impacting the culture around him because of his faithfulness to the Lord. This is where our life story is all meant to end. Now, I'm not proclaiming that our individual stories will end this way. That has a lot to do with our participation and our response, and our faith, and our obedience, and our faithfulness, or the lack thereof. But this is what God desires for us, each one of us, to come to the end of our personal story, and as people look at our lives from the big picture, we see, this is your life story. You ended in a place of great spiritual prosperity because you were faithful to him. And look at the fruitfulness that God brought about through your life because your heart was true to him and remained true to him and uncompromising in your commitment to him. So we will end our study here tonight, and we will, Lord willing, dig in soon to Daniel chapter 7 and beyond. As I mentioned earlier tonight, it gets thicker from this point. You know, the story ends, but now we have to dig into the actual prophetic passages, which are challenging and will require some more in-depth study on our part. But we don't need to shy away from those portions. There's great riches awaiting us there if we devote the kind of time that those portions deserve. So let's pray as we end this part of the study, though, tonight. Father, what an awesome testimony that we see in the life of Daniel and in the way that you laid hold of Darius and caused him, when all of the Jewish people besides Daniel and his companions fell away and drifted off into compromise and accommodation to the world and the culture around them, how you caused one ungodly man who had been born into darkness and raised in a system of darkness, you caused him to see the light and caused him to represent the truth to all of the nations of the world and fulfilled in part your great plan and purpose. What an awesome thing, Lord. And it gives me hope, Father, that even if there's one faithful one in our present generation, your purpose is not frustrated, and you will accomplish all that's in your heart for your world and for history as you define it. I pray that you would give us, each one of us, like you did Daniel, Lord, a fruitful place in that story. I pray that we would live lives of faithfulness and obedience, and that you would cause our lives to end in the same kind of spiritual prosperity that you brought about and filled Daniel's life with. And I thank you for that grace. In the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.